From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, directed by Andy Serkis, who also has a starring role. Anna and the Apocalypse, a Scottish zombie musical comedy. We'll talk about the film directed by John McPhail. And Mirai, a Japanese animated movie from Mamoru Hosoda, coming up on Film Week. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. With a trio of critics today, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Leah Lowenstein, and Wade Major of Synagogues.com. We start with Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, the action-adventure film directed by Andy Serkis. He's one of the stars of the film, along with Rohan Chand and Benedict Cumberbatch. The film written by Callie Cloves, based on Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. Wade, what'd you think of Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle?
I'm a big Kipling fan, going all the way back to my childhood, and being incredibly critical of almost all previous versions of this, forgiving of the Disney animated film, which is more Disney than Kipling, I quite enjoyed it. Andy Serkis is, of course, you know, the mocap actor behind the Planet of the Apes films and Gollum and you know, everything with Peter Jackson. He did King Kong as well. So he has transitioned into his own career as a filmmaker and an actor and exploited his ability with all of that stuff. And he has his own production company. And I think he's a very sharp director. And I found this much better than the more recent Disney film of 2016, which, you know, is a live-action CGI reimagining of the animated film with all the same songs, which didn't go down well with me. This is grittier. It's tougher. But it's still very, very imaginative. So it kind of splits the difference between those worlds, and that much I appreciate it. I'm also not a huge fan of the 1942 Korda film with Sabu. Yeah. I know a lot of people are.
Yeah,
it felt to me that's always struck me as sort of like it lets Technicolor sort of override everything else. And this I felt was the first one that has kind of gotten closer to Kipling.
Yeah, what do you think, Charles?
Well, to say it's better than that recent Disney one is like saying one is bigger than zero. It doesn't make one very big. This is the ugliest movie I have seen in years. They alter the shapes of the animals' heads so they can do facial capture for expressions. And as a result, you have kind of the uncanny valley in the jungle world. The tiger looks like a cheesy, moth-eaten prop from a Chinese New Year's parade. Mm. I don't think it's close to Kipling, and that Bagheera would never threaten Mowgli. Ka has suddenly become female to try and change Kipling's gender balance. Plus, I saw it with Claudia, and we were both really put off that the way the camera lingers over the body of this little boy who's playing Mowgli, I just found creepy. And I guess Wade saw a different cut or something because I didn't like it nearly as well.
I'm comparing it to previous versions. I mean, I don't think Kipling can ever really be perfectly captured on film. Kipling has a literary quality to it that you sort of have to transition. But this felt to me like it inhabited Kipling's world, and I rarely get that. I kind of liked the, which was it, 1994 version with Jason Scott Lee, who's a much too old Mowgli. He's a grown, chiseled Mowgli, directed by Stephen Sommers. I kind of like that sort of, but this one got me to that place, that feeling that I got when I'd read Kipling.
Well, and what a cast. I mean, Kate Blanchett, Benedict Cumberbatch, Christian Bale. A lot of talent on screen.
Frida Pinto, too.
Frida Pinto, Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, directed by Andy Serkis, rated PG-13. It's at the IPIC Theater Westwood. That just ahead of its streaming on Netflix beginning in 1 week. Anna and the Apocalypse, a zombie musical comedy. Stars Ella Hunt, Malcolm Cumming, and Christopher Laveau. John McPhail directs from Alan MacDonald and Ryan McHenry's screenplay. Wait, what'd you think of Anna and the Apocalypse?
It is, let's be clear, it is a Scottish Christmas zombie musical.
Oh, excuse me.
It's a Scottish Christmas zombie musical. It is, I actually had a lot of fun with this. It is, it doesn't end as strongly as it begins, which is partly because it follows a lot of genre conventions, and it's so much fun at the beginning. It's very hard to measure up when you're tying up all your story threads. It sort of has to now go through the motions. But it really, it plays with all of these genre conventions in a very, very clever way, and with a very low budget, too. John McPhail, who I had the privilege of meeting at the screening that I was at the other day, it's his second film. He was working with a shoestring budget and planned it rather meticulously. The idea is that here you're on the eve of Christmas and you have all of these kids, and one of them is Anna, who, you know, her dad is the janitor at the high school, and she doesn't really want to go to college like he wants her to. You have all of these sort of traditional youth issues, and then there's of course a zombie apocalypse that happens, and the next morning they find out that people are just eating each other, and you know, the whole thing. But they have, this one group of kids has to get back to where their parents are at the school. It's a very simple journey through town avoiding zombies in order to reunite the cast. It's not complicated, and along the way everybody gets their songs. One song in particular where she is singing about what a great day it is as she's walking out of her house and there are zombies just tearing things apart behind her is beautifully staged and an enormous amount of fun. And the songs are good. I'm not going to say anything in particular. There are other musicals I've seen lately where I was shocked at how not great the songs are. This one, terrific songs. Every single one of them.
Is it all in Scottish or understandable?
No, actually, it's significantly a British cast, actually. And Sarah Swire, who is terrific in this as well as another one of the kids, is Canadian. So it's a very international group, but it's Scottish made, and there are Scottish actors in it. And, you know, again, it starts to go off the rails a little bit when the would-be headmaster of the school becomes kind of a super villain halfway through. There are a lot of things that don't quite work near the end, but the songs are great. The characters are so much fun. Ella Hunt is a star in the making. She just owns this thing and carries it beautifully.
Anna and the Apocalypse, a Scottish Christmas musical comedy with zombies.
Yeah, that's it.
Anna and the Apocalypse, John McPhail, the director. It's rated R, and it's at the AMC Century City and the Arclight in Hollywood. Next, the Japanese animated adventure Mirai from writer-director Mamoru Hosoda. Mocha Kamishirashi is the star, voice star of the film. Charles, what'd you think of Mirai?
This is one of my favorite films of the year. Hosoda is one of the most interesting writer-directors working in animation, and he's talked about how he feels his films all deal with how children grow up and how they find the mentors they need to help them realize their potential. Kun, the central character of this, is a happy little boy. He's 4 years old. His father is a kind of scattered architect. His mother's an executive. Everything is fine until his mother comes home from the hospital with a baby sister. And he is no longer the center of the universe, and he doesn't like it. And he begins having a series of these fantasy adventures where he interacts with other family members, an older version of his baby sister, the family dog, who was similarly upset when he came home from the hospital because the dog was no longer king of the household, his grandfather, who was a dashing ex-soldier and motorcycle pilot, his mother is a terrible little girl. And from these adventures, he learns his place and where he now belongs in the family hierarchy and who he is, and learns to adjust. And it's absolutely charming. It may get a little long in the last section of it, but I think it's a terrific film.
We're talking about the animated movie from Japan, Mirai. Leo, what'd you think?
I liked it very much, but I think for different reasons than Charles did. I thought probably next to Inside Out, or maybe even more than Inside Out, it was one of the most authentic and imaginative takes on what it's like to be a child.
I agree.
And I thought everything from the traumas of thinking that you're lost to the annoyance of having a sibling arrive to just feeling disrespected, all of those things were expressed with so much visual brilliance and clarity. I just thought, what an imaginative take on childhood, and it really moved me too. Particularly the scene that I mentioned about when Kun thinks he is lost at the end, and it's really quite daunting, and he has to figure out, because you can't actually think. Kids can't function then. They can't even remember their parents' name. They can't even get the words out. And so it really expressed that so articulately to me.
Wade, what'd you think?
I got there eventually. It took me a little longer to get there than it did for my esteemed colleagues here. It's a little bit sentimental and cloying at the beginning. And the fantasy stuff, the really magical stuff, is what works best. It's the family stuff that was a little tough for me to deal with. Some of the music is very saccharine, and some of these situations felt a little bit contrived. So I was struggling with it a little bit in the first half hour, but honestly, by the end, it was soaring, and I was really into it.
The one objection I had was I felt the mother was really nastily portrayed. She was quite a downer, and I think she was suffering from postpartum depression. But
I'm not sure I completely agree with that. But I think some of the family stuff is, as Lael said, is very authentic. When he starts having a tantrum because he wants milk and a banana and so forth from his mother, and his father tries to give it to him, he doesn't want it from his father. Felt very real to me.
Yeah, maybe a little too real.
I think we should mention. I don't really.
Father Wade.
I don't think this is a movie for kids, really.
That's a good point. Yeah,
not for small children.
That's a good point.
It's funny. The distributor is G Kids.
Yeah.
It gets very dark, and I mean it feels real, but it might be a little too dark for.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Kids
the sequence where he gets lost is scary.
Oh yeah.
But it should be.
Mirai is the animated film from Japan. It's rated PG at Lemley's Glendale Theater and the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana, written and directed by Mamoru Hosoda. Mirai, the film. United Skates, a documentary which takes us into the world of roller skating communities, largely African American, and such performers as Coolio and Salt and Peppa are featured in Tina Brown and Diana Winkler's documentary. Leo, what'd you think of United Skates?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. It's just an energetic, ebullient kind of celebration of culture, and it also places it in a really important context. I hadn't really been aware of how important roller skating rinks were in African American culture, and the film does a really good job of situating them there. It's filmed with this kind of pulsing energy, this kind of kinetic movement that never stops, and you also get kind of a nice primer on all the different moves of roller skating, and you know
in the hospital.
Oh my gosh!
But different styles for different cities.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Every city has its own style.
And also, I mean, there's a quite a poignant aspect of it too, which is that a lot of these rinks, these rinks which became gathering places for kids to get together who otherwise would have sorted out their problems in certain cases rather violently, that those are going away. They're diminished. They're disappearing. There's this one graphic where you see how few there are left. And
oh, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it was sad.
Well, and there have been some movies to take it, like Roll Bounce and others that have taken into this, you know, dramatic films. But I don't recall a documentary.
No, what's really, really interesting here. I grew up, I'm a native Angeleno. I grew up here, surf culture. And it's something you take for granted because the beach and the ocean are never going away. But if your culture is grounded in a skating rink and suddenly they start closing, you're tearing out the heart of a community. And that's something that is really conveyed here. The other thing that I think is so extraordinary about this is a documentary whose makers very wisely understand that a documentary is not just about a thing. Mm-hmm. It still has to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And too many documentaries are just about a subject. And they just spend 90 minutes or 100 minutes telling you about a subject. This tells a story, and it has as many dramatic beats and ups and downs and curves and surprises as you would get in a narrative film. And it also is riveting.
Yeah, and there's particular families that it follows and traces, and so it really draws you in.
It has characters.
It's
wonderful.
I watched this at Wade and Lael's recommendation and was also just delightfully surprised by it. I did not know that roller skating rinks had been where many hip-hop and rap performers started out because they weren't accepted in more regular venues. Sadly, a good part of it takes place in L.A., and there's one major rink that used to be, I guess, near Hollywood that they rezoned, and it was supposed to be something commercial 4 years later, it sits empty.
And see, that's a really interesting subplot to this that's worth mentioning just really briefly, which is the zoning issue. That many of these rinks are disappearing because large developers come in, throw their weight with the political figures that be, and get the area rezoned so that they can demolish it and throw up
and
condos.
And the property becomes all that's the more. That's almost kind of like the drive-in movie theater.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, phenomenal.
There's a lot of land.
Very true.
Yeah. United Skates is the documentary. It's at Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. And then early next year, it's expected to debut on HBO. United Skates is unrated. We have more films to come, but I do hope to see you Sunday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Theater at Ace Hotel. I know that Lael and Wade are going to be there as we watch The Artist, the 2011 Best Picture winner. We're going to look at the era where films went from silent to sound, some of the great locations that are movie sites in L.A. as well. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. See you Sunday. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Wade Major, Leah Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. Next up, the animated Elliot the Littlest Reindeer, written and directed by Jennifer Westcott. Charles?
Well, this is the kind of toxic holiday jollification that's supposed to be fun for the whole family and no one enjoys. The little kids squirm, their older siblings try and sneak looks at their phones, and the adults want to go out for a cigarette even if they don't smoke. It's once again the littlest character, and he's a little horse, and he's going to try and become one of the reindeer. And there are so many weird elements in this film. The miniature horse who trains this obnoxious herd of goats has a half-blue face and speaks with a groundskeeper Willie accent. And it's a little late to be spoofing Braveheart. And then it turns out the reindeer are able to fly because they eat Mrs. Claus's magic cookies. And a nasty elf voiced by Martin Short, appropriately enough, has been slipping certain reindeer extra cookies. So suddenly, like an Olympic doping scandal is supposed to be this charming, heartwarming family event. And it's just icky. It's badly animated. The designs are ugly. And again, this is supposed to be fun for everybody and it's fun for no one.
Wow.
See, now, Charles, you're so unfair. Who has not, honestly, who can say they've never watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and thought, what would make this better is if you make it three times as long and you replace the reindeer with a miniature horse. Is there anyone who has never thought
we'll
that?
We'll make that movie.
Okay. Yeah, no, this is not good. This is. I just wanted to pull my eyes out watching this thing. I don't know why people think that just anything that's holiday themed is automatically going to play. And I don't want to be dumping on somebody's writing and directing debut, especially in animation, but this is a really misbegotten movie.
If I could just play devil's advocate for a moment.
It's
really,
okay. I did earlier.
It's
so
really,
go ahead.
It's really not that bad.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. It's really not. I was able to get my 12-year-old to sit through it, and he actually commented that it was a decent holiday movie.
So that's how he got his allowance doubled?
You know, look, it's obviously a variation on a story we've seen a bazillion times. And wasn't there just like all of the other reindeer a few years ago? I mean, it's the same tale, just retold and repackaged. But I thought it was kind of sweet. It actually reminded me a little bit of Ferdinand. Was that the bull movie from last year?
Oh, that one.
I love Ferdinand.
I like the original Ferdinand from Disney.
I like that one, too. Yeah.
All right.
It really wasn't that bad. And if you're looking for something kind of innocuous,
and your
kids
have been misbehaved, this is what to take them to that will make them stop.
Okay. Right.
Not that bad.
There's the Grinch.
That's what Lael said. Elliot, the Littlest Reindeer, is rated PG. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Never Look Away, a German drama starring Tom Schilling and Sebastian Koch. The film written and directed by Florian Henkel von Dommersmark. What'd you think, Wade?
I love this film. This is the German submission for the Academy Award this year. I think it stands a very, very good chance in an intensely competitive year of getting a nomination. Dommersmark, of course, previously won the award for his debut film in 2006, The Lives of Others, which was extraordinary. I think this is at least as good. He's famous for taking a lot of time to write his scripts, to really, really work them over and to get them to where he needs them to be. Lives of Others took him years to write. He's clearly spent a long time on this. His middle film between these two was The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie in 2010, something he didn't write. It was a for hire gig. Didn't do well, and it looks like he's taken the better part of the intervening 8 years to really get this right. It is very loosely based on the life of Gerhard Richter, the famous German painter. Came from East Germany and succeeded in West Germany after leaving East Germany. But it's loosely based. It's still very substantially fictionalized. It's about a young boy who grows up, and it's a 25-year epic period. This is a 3-hour-long film. Starts in the 1930s, goes all the way into the 1960s, and follows an artist's journey in a way that I haven't seen perhaps ever on film. It's really interesting. It is his journey as a human being, his artistic journey, both under Nazism and then under communism, and then really trying to find his voice when he comes to the West. And it ties all of that up in the journey of a man, a boy becoming a man and trying to have a family. And there's a backstory to this, a family backstory involving his father-in-law, who is an SS physician, that is devastating. And it's such a rich, textured movie. And it's rare that I see a movie that feels like a novel these days, that has that scope and that range and those emotional depths. And this one does. And I take my hat off to it. It's one of the best films I've seen this year.
Never Look Away, the German film. It's rated R, starring Tom Schilling. And it's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Invisible Hands, a documentary directed by Tracy Tandon. The film is unrated. Lael?
This is a tough film to talk about because of the subject matter, and it's flawed as a documentary, but the subject is so important. It exposes child labor in all parts of the world and child trafficking, and is with undercover footage and interviews with people who are very familiar with the situation. It documents just how rampant and widespread the child labor problem has become. And I'll tell you one thing, you will think twice before you use palm oil again, which is in basically everything that we, not just for what it's doing to the rainforest and the world and the destruction that palm oil is causing, but the fact that these children as young as 6 years old are forced to work to acquire it. It's astounding.
That's the thing, is the plausible deniability that so many corporations have, because they may not be employing children, but their subcontractors and the people that they buy other parts from might be. So sure, you could have, say, for example, and to their credit, they really underline how Apple Computer has made an enormous effort to push all the way down the pipeline to all of these ancillary companies and all of the suppliers to make sure that everybody is on board. And if anybody down line is violating this, they will be punished, and pretty severely. So it's possible as a multinational corporation to throw your weight around and make sure that these things aren't happening. That deniability is phony.
Yeah.
It's true. It's flawed as a documentary. It's not well put together necessarily. It's a very dry. It's a lot of talking heads, and it's sometimes really tough to push through. But the subject is significant. It's important, and the information in it is really vital.
Well, it's interesting to see the Nestle, the head of Nestle also sort of trying to dodge questions about their responsibility. That was really interesting.
Invisible Hands, the documentary at Lemley's Glendale Theater, and the filmmaker Tracy Tandon will take part in Q&A sessions, some of the evening and afternoon screenings. You can visit Lemley's website as well as our Film Week page to see about those special appearances. The documentary Bathtubs Over Broadway is directed by Dava Wiesenhunt, written by Ozzy Ingwanzo and David Wiesenhunt. What'd you think, Lael?
This is a wacky and delightful expose of both the passion of one man, Steve Young, who was a longtime writer at the Letterman Show, and also the completely bizarre and hitherto unexplored world of industrial musicals. And what that means is these musicals written for corporations that would be performed only at their conventions. So like Whirlpool or General Electric or like...
But never with zombies.
No zombies.
Scottish, probably.
And the weirdest range of musicals that you can imagine. And quite a bit of money was poured into them. And so Steve Young, when he discovered these musicals. In his research for Letterman, he was looking for, they used to have a segment about my favorite record, and he started discovering this whole subgenre of albums that nobody knew about. And then he became fascinated with it, and he just kept going and going and going. And his kids are like, you know, yeah, our dad's kind of a nut, but, you know, it's what,
yes,
it's
men
what he
sometimes
does.
Do.
That's
yeah,
right, right. But it's both a kind of fascinating window on a world that I knew nothing about, which is utterly hilarious. And frankly, there's one of these musicals called The Bathrooms Are Coming, which you have got to see. You'll be singing it. Yeah.
The songs are really good. It's amazing.
They are good. And some of them, it was like Candor and Ebb. Like there were.
Is that a plumbing company? The Bathrooms Are Coming?
I mean, the whole concept of industrial musicals, which still exists to some degree, too.
A little bit.
You know, like Walmart still does these things. It's very bizarre. But yeah, I didn't know what this was really about. You know, I thought bathrooms or whatever. And you're thinking, oh, it's an interesting profile of a writer. And it doesn't really show its hand very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Letterman segment that Young was responsible for, which was Dave's record collection, where he would go and pull out all these weird albums, you know, William Shatner and whoever else. And it was funny. And they'd play these clips. But it was in the process of putting those bits together that he discovered industrial musicals, because they were always albums that said for internal use only, only within the company.
Right.
These were these private vinyl albums that were never supposed to wind up in record stores. But, of course, in used record stores, they do.
Mm.
And that's how he discovered it. And it just opened up this world. But what's great about this is not just about a guy who discovers industrial musicals. He goes deeper. He has to get to know the people who did them.
He finds them.
And he finds them.
And the actors and the singers. He tracks them all down.
It's such a wonderful adventure.
And these are from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, basically. And so these people, you know, have some years under their belt. But they speak very, very fondly and affectionately.
This sounds like a blast.
It really is. It really is, Larry.
I've got to see
this. Check it out.
Bathtubs Over Broadway, the documentary at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, rated PG-13. Driver X, a drama starring Patrick Fabian and Tanya Clark, written and directed by Henry Burial, a film about a dad, stay-at-home dad, who ends up driving nights for a ride-hailing company. Lael?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting little indie. It's not dark in the way that, say, A Taxi Driver is dark, but it certainly has dark undertones as this guy begins to explore the seedier side of LA. And with Uber driving now, or Lyft driving now, becoming so, you know, such a prolific alternative to other kinds of careers, it's very appropriate that this guy who has just, in fact, he's had a record store, a used record store, and it's gone out of business. And so he and his wife need to support themselves. The wife is a bit shrill, by the way. And he has no other option, so he takes to driving the Uber, or the Driver X, it's his own company, and it's sort of thing after thing of these crazy drunken women coming into the car, or these sort of insightful kooky hippies. And I didn't love the film because it tends to get very redundant, but there is at least one scene that is absolutely worth watching, and this is his impassioned defense of what it is to own a vinyl album, talking about Frampton Comes Alive and what it felt like to hold it in his hand.
It's so
eloquent and beautifully stated, and it actually brought back to me what it is like to hold a record, a 33 in your hand in the case, and just to really appreciate that. So it has its moments. It's uneven. Has its moments.
Driver X, the drama starring Patrick Fabian, Tanya Clark. Henry Burial is the writer-director. It's unrated. Lemley's Monica Film Center. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the Chinese documentary, The People's Republic of Desire. Also the documentary, I Am Paul Walker, about the late actor. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, and I sure hope to see you at our next Film Week screening Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock. All the details about our screening of the Oscar-winning film The Artist at kpcc.org/in-person. We have good tickets available 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. And after we watch the movie, Lael and Wade are going to be with me on stage, and we'll talk about how the artist so successfully connects with audiences. What better way than to see it on a huge screen in a historic movie palace on the same street that's depicted in the film? Please join us. Film Week comes your way every Friday and Saturday here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Joined this week by critics Lael Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Next, The People's Republic of Desire, a Chinese documentary about the efforts of aspiring performers to make their fame online. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this is another film that's the subject is more interesting than the execution. More than 400 million people in China watch these streaming performers. And some of it is just talk. Some of it apparently gets rather risque. But the performers are kind of the Kardashians of China. They have no demonstrable talents, and they're famous for being famous. And they start building up followers who are either, I can't pronounce the Chinese word with the tones, young men who are stuck in dead-end jobs who, by, you know, sending in the equivalent of $10, you know, as a tip or a gift, get some sort of recognition. And then there are the filthy rich who give them extravagant presents. At one point, the young woman shows a Maserati that, you know, she's gotten. And they get to be competitions about who can give them the most and make them the number one performer and buy them the most votes. And it reveals, one, how utterly cash-oriented and corrupt the Chinese economy is, because there are syndicates who are supporting the talents, who are also putting money into the competitions, which they really don't investigate too much. But you also see this young woman is supporting her ne'er-do-well father, who's gone bankrupt, and a bunch of other relatives who are all perfectly happy to live off these people. So it's very interesting. I wish they had gone into a little more depth as to how this is all structured. And they put in a lot of computer graphics they really don't need to try and punch up the scenes. But it was something I had no idea existed.
The People's Republic of Desire, a documentary from China. Hao Wu is the director, the movie unrated, Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. The documentary, I Am Paul Walker, talks with those closest to the late actor. Adrian Buitenhuis is the director. Lael, what'd you think of the doc?
This is actually pretty compelling. It's a feature-length version of a documentary that aired, I think, earlier this year on TV, and it's goes into much more depth, really, about Walker's childhood, about his development as an actor, and about kind of what he meant to the Fast and Furious franchise. And there's it features some in-depth interviews with Tyrese Gibson and Rob Cohen, director. And it really, you know, I think Walker, it was easy to write him off as kind of a pretty boy who was blonde and gorgeous and good at everything, and a little bit, at least in the beginning, I think he was kind of a wooden actor. He didn't have a lot of range, but I think he grew tremendously as an actor. He's in a film that I liked very much that I think might have come out after he died, called Vehicle 19. Not many people saw it, but he was underrated while he was alive, but he, I think there's a great appreciation of his work has grown since then, and also of his charitable contributions. He was a tremendous philanthropist and didn't publicize very much what he did while he was alive, but it's become known since then, and so it's a nice tribute to someone whose career I think meant something.
I Am Paul Walker, documentary on the late actor, is available on video on demand from a number of different sources, including Turner Classic Movies and iTunes. It's unrated. The Taiwanese drama The Great Buddha is written and directed by Wong Sin Yao. Wade?
So this is the Taiwanese submission for the Oscar. I'm not sure if it'll get it. It's, you know, Taiwanese films are sometimes a bit of a cultural uphill push in the United States, because the history of Taiwanese cinema tends to be very restrained. Let the movie kind of speak for itself. Let the pacing sort of evolve, which this does. But it's also a black comedy, even though some people might not necessarily catch on to the humor right at first. It's shot all in black and white, except for the dash cam footage of the car in question, which is all in color. And there are a few other weird little interesting kind of meta things. But the director narrates the film as well, and he tells you that up front. I'm going to intrude every once in a while. I directed this movie, and I'll tell you what's going on. So you know that there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek thing going on. This is an expansion. The reason it's called The Great Buddha Plus is because he made a short film in 2014 called The Great Buddha. This takes that story and adds to it and inflates it. And you got a couple of guys named Pickle and Belly Button. Pickle is a kind of a night security guard. Belly Button is his buddy, who's kind of this, you know, vagrant who recycles things. And they're sitting around one night, and they decide, just for kicks, they're going to look at the recordings of the dash cam that the owner of this factory, this Buddha factory, has from his car. So they pull the chip and they put it in the computer, and next thing they know, they're watching him and all of his trysts and his liaisons in the car. The audio only, though. You see out the dash, but you hear what's going on in the car. And eventually this takes a very dark turn. It's an interesting film. It's a challenging film. I'm not quite sure that it justifies feature length, but boy, he does a really good job of making a very, very artistically challenging film and expanding it.
The movie is The Great Buddha Plus, directed and written by Wong Sin-yao. It's unrated at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. Song of Back and Neck, a comedy that stars Paul Lieberstein and Rosemarie DeWitt, written and directed by Lieberstein. Lael?
I would say allegedly a comedy. It didn't feel particularly funny to me. So Lieberstein is known as Toby from The Office. He was he has sort of one thing that he does, and he does that a lot in this film. He he suffers from chronic back pain. There's a decent scene early in the movie with Paul Feig playing his doctor, who just says, "There's really nothing you can do. There's nothing I can do. You're sort of stuck with it." And then he has to actually just grapple with the pain. Acupuncture seems to be the only thing that he can do, and he discovers in the process of the acupuncture that his back is actually musical. That it sounds funnier, I think, than it is. He meets Rosemarie DeWitt, who's going through a divorce and begins an ill-advised relationship with her. But the film sort of never takes off, I thought.
Lieberstein is an interesting guy. He was showrunner for The Office as well. He was a writer producer. He was also a producer and a writer on King of the Hill. So I mean, he's kind of bringing all of his entire skill set together here, including the Toby Flanderson character, who is basically, that's the one thing that he has. He has that one gear as an actor, and it's a bit of a weird deadpan romantic comedy about affliction and insecurity, and it doesn't quite gel, but it does have those funny scenes, those musical scenes, where he has all the needles in his back, and his pain vibrates through the needles and creates this almost theremin-like sound, so that they're bringing in other musicians, like a cellist, to accompany it. You know, it goes into some very bizarre places.
I'd seen that movie.
Those scenes are really entertaining, and Rosemarie DeWitt is really charming, as she always is. It's just it kind of lurches and then stops and lurches, and it never quite gels.
Song of Back and Neck. Paul Lieberstein, the director and star of the film. He wrote the screenplay. Lemley's Monica Film Center, the comedy, is unrated. And finally, the documentary Making the Five Heartbeats. Director Robert Townsend goes back to his film about a Motown-like musical group, the Five Heartbeats, a movie he made in 1991. Townsend directs the documentary. Wait.
You know, I love Robert Townsend, but it's rather extraordinarily vain to make a documentary about your own movie in this sense, and it that's part of the problem. That said, I still enjoyed it because there are so many interesting stories about how, you know, it was supposed to be about the Temptations, but for legal reasons they couldn't, and then they went to the Dells to have them be advisors, and the chemistry with the actors. There's a lot of interesting stuff here, just the same.
I agree. The stories are interesting that he tells, and the movie itself, The Five Heartbeats, it wasn't bad, but this was a pretty dull kind of take on it. And Townsend is many things, but a narrator he is not. It sort of, he lacks energy and enthusiasm in his narration, and it sort of drones on a bit.
Making the Five Heartbeats, documentary from filmmaker Robert Townsend, rated PG-13, Lemley's NoHo Theater in North Hollywood coming up. Our critics talk about three major passings in film over the course of the past week. The Italian director Bernardo Bertolucci, the British director Nicholas Rogue, and we'll talk about Ricky Jay, the magician and actor who also left us earlier this week. It's Film Week. The very famous theme song of Last Tango in Paris, one of the giant films from Italian director Bernardo Bertolucci, who died just a few days ago at his home in Rome at the age of 77. Bertolucci, not just the director of Last Tango with Marlon Brando, but The Last Emperor, The Conformist, other films that had a significant impact on movies. Also a somewhat controversial figure with the sexuality that he depicted on screen. Our critics are going to remember Bertolucci. And let me begin with you, Wade, and your thoughts on his film legacy.
It's an undeniably important legacy. You know, Bertolucci was part of a post-neorealist generation that kind of pushed Italian cinema beyond what neorealism had done, and explored a lot of the deeper roots of fascism during World War II. And he came from a politically leftist point of view, which was certainly influenced his work, but it wasn't dogmatic. That was what I think was so encouraging about Bertolucci, was that he sort of put these characters and these ideas and these issues out there, and he didn't decide how you were going to digest it. He left it to you. And The Last Emperor really is the culmination of that. You know, from The Conformist through Tragedy of a Ridiculous Man all the way to The Last Emperor. He once said a director really just spends his entire career making the same movie over and over. And that was very true in his career. He really did obsess over this idea of human beings lost in the tides of fate and history and politics. And I think he gave us a body of work that addresses that. You know, Last Tango, that controversy will always dog his career. It'll tarnish his reputation, deservedly so. But it was made during an era that I think we can't fairly judge unless we really understand what the 70s were like, especially for in that moment. But what he gave us still, despite all of the other controversies, is beyond measure.
And the big controversy, I mean, Last Tango itself, just as a film, is controversial in its depiction of sexuality. But in more recent years, Maria Schneider, the actress of the film, described that the simulated rape on screen included elements that she was not told of in advance. And Bertolucci, in an interview, said that was intentional, that it was not all, even though the rape was in the script, that there were aspects of it that weren't get too graphic, and that was a traumatic experience for her, as she described it. And that has, as you said, Wade, obviously had a huge effect on the perception of Bertolucci and his character as a filmmaker.
Yeah, very much so. And the thing that's unfortunate is that was not necessarily an exception to the rule at that time. You know, from the mid to late 60s into the 70s, people started doing a lot of ethically and morally questionable things in the making of movies. And it was blurring the line between what at the time was pornography and hardcore and softcore. And people, I think, felt, in keeping with a sort of the libertine attitude of the 60s all over the world, hey, you know, we can experiment now. And that experimentation crossed a line then that was certainly not acceptable, but it was not as up in front and center as it is today.
Leo, your thoughts about his legacy?
Well, I agree with what Wade said about Last Tango, and, you know, certainly in retrospect and knowing what we know now, how he handled that was not appropriate and not all right. But as you said, Wade, this was a different time, and there were extremes and technique that were being used. I for me, you know, Bertolucci, first of all, the significance of Last Tango, though, can't be dismissed partly because it is one of those cultural moments and because it's one of those movies that you know about even if you haven't seen it. You already know things about it. And so there's that. And then, you know, I think there are films that stand in my mind. I actually really liked Stealing Beauty, which he did in
the 90s.
Film. It was gorgeous, very lush, with a very, very young Liv Tyler at a villa in Italy. And he was able to kind of conjure that experience.
Even Dreamers, I'd argue, for all its flaws, had some moments that really sung in that film. I mean,
yeah,
even later on with his movies that didn't hold up in total, there were things worth seeing.
Yes, yes. Always things worth seeing.
He was always reaching for something that even he knew he couldn't achieve. And that enabled us to reach for those things as well. And so I'm willing to forgive a lot.
You think he was ambitious beyond his talent?
I think he was always ambitious beyond his talent.
I mean, and Sheltering Sky, for example, is a movie that I didn't think reached its potential. I thought
Agreed.
It could have been a lot better given the talent involved.
Should have been a lot better.
And it just didn't quite get there. So I think you're right. He was sort of reaching and not quite arriving.
Bernardo Bertolucci, the Italian director, dying earlier this week at the age of 77. Nicholas Roeg, the British director who did The Man Who Fell to Earth, co-directed Performance, Don't Look Now, the psychological thriller with Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie. He passed away at the age of 90. Also, the Australian coming-of-age film Walkabout.
Larry, that film had a tremendous influence on
Walkabout.
Me. Walkabout? Yes.
Me too.
I saw it as a young girl, probably 7 or 8 years old. Didn't get it all, but the kind of visual collage that he put together, and this crazy weird adventure of these kids being kind of abandoned in Australia and going on this walkabout with this Aboriginal kid. It was weird. It was insecure. It was confusing, and it just got under my skin. That lingers with me.
That's what Roeg did. You know, he was a camera operator on Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And David Lean was going to elevate him to cinematographer on Dr. Zhivago until it was very clear that they didn't have quite the same aesthetic. And that's when Roeg went off and pursued a career as a cinematographer on things like Mask of the Red Death for Roger Corman, and then dovetailed into these really stylistically aggressive movies of his own. And like Bertolucci, I mean, we forget that, you know, Last Tango was a sex scene that really lit the world on fire. But a year later, there was a sex scene in Don't Look Now by Nick Roeg.
That all those was, quick cuts.
Which mm-hmm. was equally as incendiary with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps more than Bertolucci, I think his career defined and redefined eroticism for that particular era and generation.
And in fact, earlier this week, I think it was Sutherland again had to deny that it was
yeah.
real sex
yeah.
in the movie.
Yeah.
Said, no, this was, you know, we were doing a movie. It's acting. Nicholas Roeg dying at the age of 90. And Ricky Jay, who best known as a master comedian, the man who could, you know, throw playing cards and hit melons, you know, across the room, but also a very compelling actor. I think in Boogie Nights, for example, his work in Paul Thomas Anderson film, Ricky Jay, successful characters he created.
Yeah, one of those guys, one of the rare people who can cross over from magic to comedy to drama and somehow manage to have a very successful career in all of those areas. It's an unfortunate and untimely loss.
Yeah, Jay died at the age of 72. One of the things I love about Ricky Jay is when you see him act, you always felt like there was so much more there that wasn't being mm-hmm. revealed about the character that he played. Ricky Jay, the gifted and widely admired magician and scholar of magic, as well as actor, died of natural causes at the age of 72. Well, our thanks to you for joining us for our film week, and I sure hope we see you Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our next film week screening and the last one of 2018. The Artist, the Oscar-winning film of 2011. Just a tremendous film, and what better way to see it than in an historic movie palace on the giant screen at Theater at Ace Hotel. And Wade and Leo will be with me afterwards to talk about The Artist on stage. Get your tickets right now, kpecc.org/in-person. Hope to see you Sunday afternoon at 1.